You're listening to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 29.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Alfonso Funky Pants.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry.
That's awesome, though.
And I'm Dave Robinson.
Alfonso.
And I'm Dave Robinson.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, no, really, I am. I'm Dave Robinson. I'm telling you.
Okay, good. And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
On the Roundtable Podcast, besides assuming ridiculous pseudonyms, Brian, also known as Sir Studio, and I invite writers to come onto the show and pitch a story idea to us and our esteemed guest host.
That's right. And then we dig into it, flip it on its head, spin it around, blend it up, and mold it into a solid and writable story. Something that Dave likes to call...
Tomato aspic. Oh, no, no, no.
Literary
gold. If you blend it and whip it up, I mean, that's that, and you pour it into a mold, I mean, that's tomato aspic, baby.
That's a good word.
It is.
We did that once. We were trying to make salsa, and it just didn't work.
And you made tomato aspic.
It's
like the dying ground of all failed salsas and pico de gallos. It's tomato aspic, so that you don't have to feel like a complete failure. So, it's literary gold that we're going
for. Yes, literary gold is what we're trying to achieve here.
Oh, my God. Now, just real quick, Brian,
what's
going on with you, man?
Oh, what's not going on with me? I start school tomorrow, which once this recording goes up will have been like a month and a half ago. I get to go back and I'm already trying to come up with some lesson plans. And of course, you know, I teach like five English 10s and then one creative writing. And which one is the one that I'm really concerned about right now?
I have no idea.
Creative writing.
Oh, well, that's the one you're focused on. You have no reason to be concerned about it.
Well, so, my concentration is going into it.
You've got major mojo working in that department. So are you looking forward to certain students coming back, or is it all just a teenage haze for you?
I would be looking forward to certain students coming back, except that
the way that
all the classes are set up, I never see the same students twice unless they fail my class.
Oh,
you know, and those are the students I don't want to see again.
Well, except for those students that like you so much, they purposely fail just so they can glean more of your wisdom, your radiance one more time.
I love that fantasy world, Dave.
Well, and speaking of fantasy worlds, let's roll on and introduce our guest host for this episode of the Roundtable Podcast. Folks, you met him and were lulled into a complacent and glorious learning haze with him in last week's 20 Minutes With. He returns once again to the round table and the big chair, crafter of exquisite tales, winner of awards, journaler of epic journeys and adventures. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Mr. David D. Levine. David, thank you so much for rejoining us and helping us workshop an episode or a storyline today.
It's just like being the returning champion on Jeopardy.
Yes, exactly. Yes, see, and I've been hoping somebody would feel that way, and you have taken us there. Thank you. Thank you. So, David, you've got lots going on behind you. I can only imagine the miasma of awesomeness that is laid out before you. Would you be so kind as to share with our listeners what's coming up in David D. Levine's day planner for the next month or so?
Well, I've got a lot of stuff that's either going to be coming out real soon or has already come out by the time this podcast airs. An anthology from John Joseph Adams called Armored, has a story of mine. I've got a story in Digital Rapture, a series of an anthology of singularity stories edited by Jim Kelly James Patrick Kelly is one of the two editors of Digital Rapture. I've got a story in Buzzy Mag on buzzymag.com online called Floaters, which is a creepy horror story. And I've got coming out sometime this year, I'll have a story in the anthology Old Mars, edited by Gardner Dozois and George R. R. Martin. I'll have a novelette in Beneath Ceaseless Skies coming out sometime. That's a webzine that's coming out sometime this year. And I will have a reprint of Tick, 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 which is the first time my Hugo-winning story has been reprinted in an American publication, will be coming out in 21st Century SF, edited by David G. Hartwell and Patrick Nielsen Hayden, which will come out later this year from Tor.
Wow. Holy smokes. Now, one of the wonderful things about you, Dave, is that you have a wonderful, compact and articulate page that describes all of these wonderful things that are coming up, things that have gone on in the past. Would you share with our audience the URL for that so that they can stay abreast of all this coolness?
You can find it at bentopress.com/SF. That's Bento Press. Bento is a little magazine my wife and I do. So Bento Press is not really a press, but bento.com was taken. So bentopress.com/SF for science fiction. And that's where I am.
I wonder how many times an available URL has impacted a corporate name or identity.
These days, a lot, which is why we have things called Flickr and GooWow, and I mean there's almost nothing utterable that isn't a URL at this point.
Yeah, you almost have to pull out a vowel or a consonant or two and right. Pretend like you intended to do that all along.
Yeah, or else just buy it. Like Twitter came up when Flickr was really hot, and it was originally spelled without that E, Twitter. But they bought Twitter.com as it became obvious that they were going to become a success.
Okay.
Twitter with an E.
They shelled out the bucks and they said,
they shelled
this.
Out the bucks.
Awesome. What about conventions?
Go out and buy a bunch of URL names and just pray that somebody needs that as their company name.
That's called cyber squatting.
Squatting, yes. And that's considered bad form, Mr. Humphrey.
Okay, fine. Ruin all my fun, Dave.
All your evil plans. We're going to need to get you and Dr. Brain Fever together so you can go conquer the world together. David, you've got cons coming up that you're going to as well, correct?
I've, unfortunately, by the time this podcast airs, I'll have just been to the Worldcon, but I'll be at World Fantasy in Toronto, and then probably a bunch of stuff next year. I go to a lot of conventions, so if there's a major convention, I try not to miss WISCON, and I will definitely be at FogCon, and I'll be at Fool's Cap, small convention in the Seattle area in late September. So okay. Yeah, I hit a lot of cons. I've hit about 5, 7, 10 cons a year some years.
See, now with anyone else, I would say that was a good marketing and networking tool. But I'm betting, David, and I might be off base here, that you're going because you're a colossal geek nerd and you just love going to the cons.
Absolutely.
See,
I've been going to cons since I was a wee bairn in small prints.
Toddling through the aisles, touching all the action figures.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Well, we will make sure that there are links to all of that fabulosity in the liner notes so that our listeners can follow up on all of that goodness. And certainly if anything happened at Worldcon that should be announced, by golly, we'll put that in there as well. But for now, what do you say we take a brief pause to promote another worthy podcast or superior audiobook? And when we return, we can workshop a story. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Sounds fabulous.
I like it too. So let's go ahead and do that. Friends, stay tuned. We will be right back.
I crouched low in the dim light, my gaze sweeping across the ruined grandeur of the lost temple of Abu Harabi. Before me on a stone altar, still black with blood spilled from 1,000 human sacrifices, lay the Tablet of Infinite Delights. I lifted it carefully and placed it in my satchel, and it was then I heard the slithering scrape of 100 serpents. I turned, drawing my pistol, and gaped at the horror that had risen before me. A black tentacled beast from my darkest nightmare. It rose higher and higher, and I feared for my very soul. But the thing's bulk crashed into the ceiling, collapsing it and allowing me to scrabble away with my life, my sanity,
and my prize. Later I examined it, translating the ancient script. For adventure of a bygone era, the tablet read, tune in to Protecting Project Pulp, a weekly podcast of classic pulp tales guaranteed to get your pulse pounding. You can tune in to the thrills of Protecting Project Pulp starting Tuesday, July 17th. Visit their website at www.protectingprojectpulp.com for more information. Protecting Project Pulp, where adventure truly begins.
Lords and ladies of the Roundtable Podcast, welcome back. We are jumping into the workshop proper section, and we have some really awesome people on today. You've met David Levine, and Dave, who do we have as a writer?
I'm sorry, I'm still basking in the glow of Lords and Ladies of the Roundtable. That was sexy. That was awesome. yes, let's do. We can't have a workshop without a brave guest writer stepping up and saying, yes, let's talk about my story. And Brian, our guest writer for this episode is a PhD candidate at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, where he studies, I love this, pulp fiction and modernism.
Fabulous.
That's just beyond awesome. He maintains a few blogs and websites, including a coffee and a paperback, The Spiral Tower, and Novums. And his most endearing quality, I think, Brian, is the fact that one of his most prized possessions is his replica of Conan the Barbarian's sword.
God, I love it.
I love this guy. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the roundtable, please, Mr. Jason Carney. Jason, dude, I know it's never easy to put your baby up on the examination table, so we really appreciate you stepping up and doing that, man. Thank you.
Sure, sure. Thank you.
Yeah, you betcha. So Jason, PhD in pulp fiction, and friends, it's only fair to warn you, I also host another podcast, Protecting Project Pulp, and Jason and I are featured occasionally in there. I'm the host, but I brought Jason in a number of times to discuss pulp fiction. Jason, how did you get into this whole literary thing?
It's actually connected to genre fiction, fantasy.
Yeah.
I read The Hobbit in the fifth grade, you know, found out that J.R.R. Tolkien was a professor, and that's what I've been trying to do.
Is Bam.
Is become a professor. And the various, you know, things that I've you know, come to study is just, you know, as a result of, like, following that path through and also following, like, what interests me. So
that's awesome. And you can't go wrong when you're following your bliss, baby. That's what Joe Campbell said. So, and yeah, it turns out that it seems like either Tolkien or Howard popped a lot of our fantasy cherries back in our teenage years. So yeah, that's a metaphor I won't be trotting out again anytime soon.
It works.
So Jason, you did bring a story with you for this episode, yes?
Oh gosh.
one up. Wait, I got one right here. Hold on.
Yes.
All right, cool. We give you 5 to 8 minutes. Okay. Give us title, genre, format, whether it's a short story, a novella, multi-length series, whatever. Give us, you know, if the world's unique, give us that. Tell us about the main characters, antags and protags. Give us key sign points to the story, and then we'll get into workshopping it. So, Master Carney, the mic is all yours. We're shutting up.
Okay. All right. So, generally, I would call this, like, an apocalyptic utopian story. Even though I, like, study genre fiction, I'm not really good at, you know, determining the genre of the stuff I write. So apocalyptic utopian fiction, I've just created a genre.
Boom.
The tagline of, you know, this is actually just a novel. The tagline of the novel is as follows. After the artificial ecology that has sustained the remnants of humanity is compromised, a selfish man must learn to lead in order to bring his family through myriad dangers to a new home, to a new state of being. Okay.
Excellent.
If there was a theme, I would say that it would be the price we pay for knowledge, the power of knowledge, or just non-knowledge at all. The setting, it's in the future. The Earth has sustained a complete ecological disaster. The biosphere can no longer support life. What remains of humanity is in this giant arcology. It's like 500 square miles or about there. It's a balanced ecosystem, and it consists of three regions, three concentric circles. The Great City is in the center. The Great Sward is, out next to that. That's where all the farms and the little villages and like the woods are. And then the Great Lake, which is the farthest out circle. There's lots of characters, but the two characters that I've been gravitating towards are George and his wife Asher, and I'll say some things about them. The society in the arcology is extremely organized. It's pseudo-feudalistic. George is a noble. He's the head of a giant household. He has like 300 people in this household, an entire town with like farmhands, skilled craftsmen, merchants, house servants, guards. They have like a little military, if you will. He's not much of an executive at all. He's somewhat selfish, and he's like preoccupied with esoterica and history of the arcology, his family genealogy and chess. Very much kind of a hands-off sort of, noble lord of this little, town in the Sward. He leaves the day-to-day running of the village to his wife, Asher. His wife, Asher, she is also of like the noble caste. She becomes a mystic. She starts off as just like a, person preoccupied with basically the logistics of running the community. But she starts having all these prophetic dreams about an idol that's carved of wood, and that keeps revealing to her certain truths. Now, there's lots of other characters, like there's blacksmiths and merchants, and there's a bartender at the town that George goes to, but I'm not going to go into them. Also, they have three sons that, are pretty important to the story. So the major conflict. Okay, so when the novel begins, there's a catastrophe. Something happens over the Great Lake, but the government covers it up. However, this catastrophe upsets the ecological balance of the ecology very quickly. Things start to get really weird. There's no rain. The temperatures start to go all over the place. The fish die. All of the fish die. The crops fail. And the air quality starts to, really go bad. These isolated problems become like, basically, people start getting desperate and hungry, and so the first third of the novel is like the denigration of the arcology, and then it becomes about like everything is falling apart. The second third of the novel would be where George actually has to become a leader. So where he's been hands off, now he has to deal with some really difficult problems with enough food, protecting the household from marauders, very desperate people. That ends with him becoming, rising to the challenge. And his wife, once again, is going through these various transformations to like more of a prophetess. Near the end of the novel, the last third, they realize that this arcology has been completely compromised and everything is dying and everyone is going to die. Asher has her big epiphany, and she says, we need to leave. We need to get out of this, place. And so it becomes kind of exodus. They get all of the household together. They march their way through the Great Sward, and they try to get to the Great Lake. And lo and behold, there's a giant hole in the sky that, that's the source of the ecological imbalance. And they have built a spiral tower to the hole, and it ends with them climbing the tower and going into the darkness.
And that's how it ends?
That's how it ends, yeah.
Okay, all right. Very good. Well done, sir. Well done. All right, before we go any further, Master Humphrey, if you would be so kind, deliver the sacred disclaimer.
It would be my pleasure. So, in the course of workshopping this fabulous story that you have brought to us. David, Dave, and myself will all have our own unique input and be throwing lots of different things at you, and you have every right in the world to accept or disregard anything that we have to say as complete and total bullshit.
Bam. Total truth. And yes, for the course of this discussion, because David is David, I can be Dave. You can also, I answer to T-Bone as well. So
yes,
Dave or T-Bone.
Which scares me.
Yes, well, deal with it. And David for our guest host. So David, we generally defer the first round of questions and observations to our guest host. So if you would, what are your first impressions of Jason's story idea? Any questions of clarification that you have? Go ahead and start us off on this discussion.
Wow. There are a few. I mean, obviously, if you're just trying to summarize a novel length work in just a few minutes orally, there's going to have to be a lot of details that are left out. So I have a lot of questions that I think would be immediately answered by reading the book. One of the questions that I have about the book, and I'm just going to throw these all out at once, so don't try and answer them one by one, is okay. Do the people know at the beginning of the story that they're in an arcology? Because it's like they didn't know, they were surprised to find a hole in the ceiling, but at the same time, you said that George is a student of the history of the arcology. So it's not clear to me whether or not the people are supposed to know that this is an arcology, or whether they think this is just the world, this is the way it is, this is the way it's always been. Having it be both a feudal government and also to have a government cover-up is very strange. It's like, do these people have a high technology? Do they have a democratic government? Do they have communications and technologies, and they simply do not choose to use them for some means? Has this been withheld from them? Is there a government that they interact with who is responsible for maintaining the ecology while keeping the people in feudal ignorance? Or do we have a feudal society which nonetheless is also aware of and involved in the maintenance of their high-tech ecology? These are all world building questions. The character questions, I have big questions around George, in that if George has to step up and become a leader, there needs to be something that George has at the beginning of the book that makes us want to stick with him while he's growing into the character that he's going to have to be at the end of the book. So he needs to show potential. He needs to be somebody who has He's not just a slacker layabout hobbyist. That he has to be somebody who has hero nature, even if he hasn't quite stepped up to the bat yet. I also have some questions about Asher. You say that Asher has visions about some wooden idol. I do not understand what the connection is between Asher's visions and the hole in the ceiling. Where does the wooden idol come in? I also have to raise the question of, is this a world in which magic exists? Or is it a post-apocalyptic technological environment, in which case there isn't any real magic? Where do these visions actually come from? What's really going on with the visions? And then when it comes to the end, you say they have built a spiral tower. And I wonder, who is they? Who built this tower? And how did they build the tower on top of the lake? And then, so the 300 people from George's town, they climb up the spiral tower and they come to the hole in the roof. Well, you said earlier on that the planetary ecology had been destroyed and all the remaining survivors are in this 500-mile-wide arcology. So if the planetary ecology is that bad, and we know it's pretty bad outside because a hole in the roof is enough to disrupt the environment of the ecology, then when they do get outside, well, they're going to have to climb down just as far as they've climbed up to get down to the surface outside. And what are they going to find? Are they even going to find breathable air? So as an ending, unless we have a lot more information about what's going on outside, that's a really unsatisfying ending to me.
Good initial points. Jason?
Wow.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What you got, bud?
Well, I guess just to answer some of the questions, they don't. Most people in the arcology do not know that they're in an arcology. It's a caste system, and so knowledge about their, you know, where they are and, you know, their history is basically doled out
So they don't ever like walk into a wall and go, "Gee, this wall goes around the whole world." Does that ever happen?
That's why the Great Lake is there, you know, and nobody can go past certain buoys and that sort of thing.
Okay.
The government, there's so much I don't want to give away because I mean, I guess I need to if I'm going to get it workshopped.
Yeah, you got it.
Yep.
Yeah. At this stage of development, you can't hold anything back because we're not going to be able to critique your ending unless you tell us how the story comes out.
Yeah. Well, maybe what inspired the story? This will answer a lot of the questions. Quick story. There was a country club down the street from my house that was overgrown, and it was purchased by a developer, and it'd been overgrown for 6 years, and it was behind walls. And when the developers completely destroyed all of the forest, actually, you know, it was this abandoned country club. All of the animals in the country club become a forest. Started just, you know, running all through the suburbs and getting hit by cars, and you know, and so I guess I wanted to map that onto, you know, the human situation. So like, where do they go when they go through the hole? You know, I guess I have a, it's not going to be a good thing for them. They're going to, you know, they're going to die when they go through the hole.
So the end of your book is that you're going to create these characters and you're going to ask the reader to sympathize with these characters and work with them through their struggles through the entire length of the book, and then you kill them all.
Yes. Yeah.
Dude, no.
that's kind of not, that doesn't have bestseller written all over it.
Oh man. Yeah.
You got to give it up. Give it up. You know, Jason.
It can work. There's a book called We All Died at Breakaway Station, and guess what happens at the end of the book?
They all die.
There's another book called The Wreck of the River of Stars, which is a dynamite book that didn't get nearly as much critical attention as it deserves. And that, too, is a story in which you know from the beginning that everybody's going to die at the end. So you can totally make a book where everybody dies at the end work. But I got to tell you, it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? I think you just hit on something that in both of those instances, the reader knows at the very beginning that everybody's going to die. And I think that's a pivotal difference between those and a story where you're blindsided by it at the end.
Yeah.
And then kind of let down.
If the point of the story that the people are in this sort of enclosed artificial environment, and then they get outside and they just can't cope with the outside and they all die, I think what you kind of have here is you have a short story. And most of the story takes place on the outside as you watch them die. That's, you know, if what you want, if that's the ending that you want, then I think you're spending a lot of time getting up to it.
Yeah.
Well, when I say they all die, like I imagine this as being a three novel series.
Okay.
The first novel would be, they find out the arcology is artificial and they leave. And then there is this exodus and they're like, attempt to, find a new home. And then the third novel would be when they make contact with what has happened to the Earth. And I have some like really, basically the Earth has been completely, all of the minerals, anything of any value has been extracted by an alien species. And they make contact with one of these aliens, and it's like, I'm sorry, you know. It's another thing. It's like whenever like they companies want to like develop an area, and they set aside a nature preserve, and then they develop it, and then they like, you know, what happens after that development, prospers, and then like all the stores leave, and the next thing you know, there's just that little nature preserve next to it. So I'm trying to like. It would be a three novel series where it'd be like a steady but sure realization on the part of the characters of like what's actually happened.
So break down for us, Jason, just real quick in just one sentence each. Book one is about X, book two is about Y, book three is about Z.
Okay. Book one, leaving the arcology.
Okay.
Book two, trying to find a new home. And book three, making contact.
With?
The aliens.
The aliens, okay.
So they don't.
And this, well, that's just it. It'd be like the contact they make with the aliens would be like the contact a deer fleeing that, country club would make with a car. You know what I mean? So it's going to be a bad contact. It's not going to be like, oh, you know, I finally discovered, you know, these aliens who've been extracting everything. And, you know, when they make a contact with the aliens, when they actually connect to the ones, it's not going to be an anthropological contact.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the like fact that the aliens have extracted all the resources from the Earth, leaving only a small number of people alive, you know, this does not make them out to be the sort of people who are going to be sympathetic.
Yeah.
This ain't E.T.
No.
E.T., go home.
Yeah. Okay.
So you know, this is a structure that can be made to work. But if you're now going to ask your readers to follow these characters and fall in love with them through three books, only to see them all be killed by aliens at the end of book three, you know, that's people are not going to like that ending, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, anything can be made to work. One of the things about the writing biz is you can get away with anything as long as you can sell it. And I use the word sell it in both senses of the word. You know, if you can convince the reader and you can convince the editor, then you can get away with it. You can do things that are completely impossible. I mean, there's plenty of stories, successful stories, that break the rules. But you really need to earn it. You can break the rules if you really want to, but you got to earn it or people will not pay money for it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I really like the idea of, you know, thinking about this as a short story, or even like a novella. I know those are hard. I've read those are hard to sell these days.
Damn near impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess like the, not to take it to a thematic level, but like I'm interested in the distinction between, like, you know, there's this world of the senses and experience. You know, there's just like what we can see with our like five senses, and then there's the world that I think is like beyond, like in like a almost like a spiritual sense, and that's the world that Asher is connecting to. There's this like there's a basic like the long philosophical debate between like two types of knowledge. Episteme knowledge is, you know, everything science does, where you like are using like your technology to amplify your sense, your sensory organs to like know the world. But like people who would use the other way of knowledge, which is called gnosis, I think that's how you pronounce it, is you access it through
intuition. You
know, what intuition or just kind of feeling or spontaneous or actually there's some traditions that call it non-knowledge. You know, like ecstasy in like this old religious sense is like the feeling of like you're basically your head's exploding. The ecstatic experience is the experience where your senses all fail you.
Well, and you've built that up. You've established that with George being more of the historian and the analytical, and Asher evolving into the mystic. Brian, what are your first? David, thank you. Those are questions that needed to be raised, and I think can be dealt with during the course of the discussion. I want to get Brian's first impressions on this.
Sure. Okay. A couple things. Everything that David brought up was like way beyond where I was thinking, and I love it. And so, you know, I'm glad that we spent some time and focused on that. I have a tendency to get a little more local. And I know when we were talking the other day, we were talking about global, you know, looking at it globally. One of the things that I was curious about is it almost seems like Asher is a more interesting character and could make a better protagonist than George.
Yes. Same thing occurred to me.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is I think David made a really good point that with George, you know, if we don't give a shit about him at the beginning, if there's not a redeeming quality about him, and then all of a sudden he, you know, he steps into the role of the protector and the leader, we're going to be like, oh, great, it's that asshole, you know? but I think that if you focus on Asher and you let Asher be the... maybe the point of view in the first part, you can have George be kind of a slacker, kind of a, you know, not necessarily a slacker, but more, he's more concerned with his things and not as concerned with his people and running his village. And then as things go and the relationship between Asher and George, I think that then we can start to see him kind of come in and flourish and not necessarily develop those redeemable qualities, but pull the mask and the, you know, all the stuff that's been weighing that down. wipe that away and start to become a character that we can get behind, and then you can split the POV later and we'll care about him. And that might be a cool way to kind of bring him in. Another question that I had that has to do with the information that everybody has, or that only certain people have, the select people, is who controls that information as opposed to just the government. I want to see characters specifically that are in some way manipulating things, maybe. And it might even be intriguing, because I was thinking, okay, who approves, who gets to know what? And is it just that they're a noble, or is it, you know, are there certain people that are being selected? And how long have they been here? Has it been generations and generations, so that when they go out, maybe the Earth has kind of reclaimed itself and they can breathe the air, you know? And then what if the history that the people who know the history, what if it's not the real history? It's the history that they were taught to keep them subservient. And that's a big revelation when they get outside. Is that everything that they've been taught, even the people who felt noble because they're like, I know the history and I'm sworn to secrecy, I'm not allowed to tell anybody, but little things get out here and there. If all of it is false, all of it was yeah. constructed to keep them under someone's thumb.
Yeah. David, did you have a comment earlier on there?
Those are great comments, Brian. And I think you've really nailed a few things that I hadn't considered. I mean, when you ask, you know, you ask about the government, really the story as described has no antagonist. What you've just described is the antagonist of the story. Is who is it? Who is this conspiracy? Who is keeping information? What are they keeping back, and what are they revealing, and why? You know, what are their motivations, what are their actions, and who? As people, you have to have people to be antagonists.
Sure.
That's a great question. Who is structuring this society?
The government is this is sounding weird. It's an artificial intelligence that was a software that was installed by the aliens who built the arcologies. So when they built these arcologies, they built them not only to, you know, ecologically function, you know, by themselves in balance, they also built them socially to function in balance. So basically in the center of this shadow conspiracy that is the government is an AI software program that is doling out information, organizing people, and it's, so in a weird way, it's the aliens who built this, you know, but it's no different than, like, if I was to have like a hamster cage and I was to put a wheel in the hamster cage, and the wheel is just there, you know, for the hamster to have something to do. You know,
sure.
The AI, that this extremely sophisticated intelligence personality administrator that is smacked in the middle of the of the arcology that it kind of emanates its tendrils out and becomes the government. It's just a completely indifferent, you know what I mean, tool that the aliens use to kind of keep the arcology going.
Sure.
Right, but there's a structure underneath that. There are people who are reporting directly to the AI who know what's really going on. Those are your antagonists.
Oh yeah.
Or perhaps if the AI is truly, you know, an artificial intelligence, if it actually has some agency and a personality, then maybe the AI is your big bad.
Yeah.
So what you've got is you've got a story that starts off looking like a medieval fantasy and turns out to be a dystopian alien invasion story.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it can totally work. I mean, Gene Wolfe, Book of the New Sun, especially in the Short Sun world books is all over that kind of territory.
Yeah. And Jason, let me share some observations, a minor detail. If it is a closed environment, then population is going to be monitored and controlled somehow.
Yeah.
You can't let people breed out of control beyond the means of the arcology to sustain them. So there's going to be some mechanism in there to ensure that does not happen. That might be completely unknown and a very subtle thing, like a disease that's introduced by the AI that nobody notices. But that's not very interesting. There might be something a little more overt, whether, you know, I don't know if you want to go like a Hunger Games thing, but some sort of tournament. Maybe there are mysterious deaths. Maybe there's a superstition about a cloaked shadow of death that moves through the various towns and periodically kills people, takes them away to whatever. I mean, do they have a religion in this place? Do they have a sense of an afterlife?
That's a big issue that I haven't talked about. It's basically the orthodoxy. Like they would be the big antagonists. You know, when Asher starts having her spiritual experiences, one of the ways that I kind of present, I'm going to try to present George as a good guy, is he's not really on board with the orthodoxy, like the priests of the you know, arcology, who basically have a direct link to this AI, Yeah, so
there is a faith in there, and this dark figure could be a part of that faith.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me point out a couple of very cool parallels or contrasts that you've created here, whether consciously or not. Asher, you described as initially a very logical person, somebody who deals with logistics and the organization, the tangible structure, and she goes from that to becoming a mystic. Which is interesting, especially considering your discussion earlier about the two types of knowledge, the tangible knowledge and the gnosis. It would be very interesting if George went on the same journey in reverse.
Yeah.
If he started out very... you described his interest in history, and that, I think, is going to be a strong linchpin for you, and also for the reader to discover and explore what's really going on here. You know, his he can be this sort of fluffy, ooh, look at these old charts I found about the way this city looked, you know, 50 years ago or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And nobody really takes him very seriously, although his knowledge of, you know, the available technology, maybe the ecological cycles exceeds those of others because he pays such close attention to things, but nobody really pays attention to him. It occurs to me that what if he finds, and again, I'm throwing the MacGuffin out there because I'm MacGuffin boy, but what if he finds a hidden cache of logs from the first days of the arcology? Or what if there's rumor of some cache and he's always been seeking this treasure trove of knowledge to the detriment of his community and his people because he's so committed to learning and knowledge and understanding. And then later on, when the crisis happens, he becomes the guy who's saying, no, don't you see? This means this, and this means this. If we don't leave now, we're all going to starve to death. And everybody goes, yeah, right, whatever. And ultimately, this knowledge that he's hoarded and has made him a laughingstock turns him into somebody who people can then turn to. And then, as you described, he must become the leader because he's now the guy that has the information that will save them.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the idea of, you know, Asher and George changing places, you know, to some extent.
Yeah,
you
know, I think that's
cool. He ends up organizing the community and leaves his, you know, poetry and history, fluffy history behind, and she ends up, you know, being the mystic, you know.
Right, which would create some interesting character dynamics between the two of them as they both go through that transformation. If they truly love each other, and I think they should, or if they don't, maybe they can, this new spark sparks this passionate romance that hasn't been there for a while. I don't know. But a little romance is not a bad thing.
Yeah. On the other hand, that change could also drive them apart. You know, you're not the man I married. You know, there's going to, in some ways they're becoming more like each other, and yet they're becoming so different from their own previous selves that might put some friction in the relationship at first.
Yeah,
You know, thinking about this dichotomy between gnosis, you know, Apollonian and Dionysian, or intuition and science, as a science fiction reader, you're gonna have to really, really sell that gnosis thing to get me to buy it for purposes of believing in it for the length of the book, because what you've got here is you've got the arcology, you've got aliens, you've got AI, you have people fighting their way across a collapsing ecology. All of this is hard science stuff, and every bit of it can be explained without recourse to anything outside of physics. And then you have them being guided by visions. And in this science fictional universe, you really have to explain how these visions work. And if you're just going to wave your hands and say, oh, it's gnosis, it's a different kind of knowledge, As a science fiction reader, I'm not going to accept that, and I'll put the book down. You need to have the Gnosis part work within the universe of the book. And there's two ways you can do it. You can either have the Gnosis be something that's really scientific in some fashion, and it can even be mock scientific, like the Bene Gesserit in Dune. You know, it doesn't really work that way, but it works for the purposes of the book. Or alternatively, you can set up the universe as being a universe that isn't quite a rational universe in the way that hard science fiction is. You know, if you establish that this Gnosis is a part of the world from the very beginning, then the reader will say, oh, okay, fine, I can buy that, and I'll run with it. But you need to have that dichotomy resolved in one of those two ways, or in some way, in order for the book as a whole to work.
How about this? Jason, what if the aliens that came down were not of a single mind? What if they are a colony of aliens, and the bulk of them are there for the resources to rape the Earth, blah, 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 but there is another sect, or maybe multiple sects within the alien culture, who take local life forms and, I'm not going to say experiment on them, but, and I don't want to go all David Brin uplift saga on you, but pull them aside so that the miners can go and get their metric tons of awesomeness. Mm-hmm. And in these arcologies, they're using these to A, study the local life forms and the cultures, and so they're sociologists in that respect, anthropologists, galactic anthropologists, but also what if they're genetically altering subtly?
What if
they're introducing post-hypnotics, something to evolve the culture in preparation for joining the larger organization? Maybe this is the payment. Okay, we took your planet, but we're going to give you the capability to join a larger culture if you have the balance of the Gnosis and the knowledge, the science and the intuition.
For every 90 Donald Trumps, there are 10 Jane Goodalls.
Right. You know,
maybe that's why the arcology even exists. Is the arcology was put together by the anthropologist aliens who really want to save humanity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tell my wife, like, if there are aliens, I hope there are bleeding heart aliens too. You know what I mean? Who like care for us? I remember there was this one time I was on the back porch of my folks' house, and we were playing Axis and Allies, and this cat comes up, and it's like, you know, just a sack of bones. It's, you know, freezing and cold, and it's, you know, scared, and it just comes up, and you know, we pet it, and it starts purring. You know what I mean? That's a point of contact between species. Like, I can see the same thing happening. You know, maybe I don't have to kill them all. Maybe whenever they're trying to make contact, they don't make contact with the you know, the person who just says scat cat and like kicks it away. Maybe they make contact with that, you know, with a cat shelter. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Does this metaphor work at all?
I kind of like the more, and this is personal, this is not, this would make it a better story. This is Dave saying, I would like to know there's a larger purpose other than happenstance that we just happen to meet the lucky alien who's not going to squash us like a bug.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, you know, it could be that that's the type of story. I mean, when you go through all of this hardship and you come out of the arcology and it's like, oh, look, a wasteland of barely breathable air. Fabulous. Yeah. You know, that's kind of a bummer of a story.
Yeah.
Now, what if you work it in that it's a failsafe, that, you know, the aliens have set this thing up and maybe they leave for a little while. And it's one of those things that, well, if things start to fall apart, then this DNA activation kicks in that gives certain humans these visions and helps them find a way out to survive until we get back.
Hmm. That's intriguing.
That's kind of options.
The visions are communications from the anthropologists.
Right. There you go. Yeah. Wow. Yes. Yeah. And that's how she's interpreting them. Yeah.
Right. And then in that sense, she's going to have no idea where it's coming from, but the mystery of it and the intrigue is what keeps us going.
The cool thing of that is that then Asher and George are both incredibly important people on whom the entire arcology depends, whether the arcology is aware of it or not.
Yeah. And you're going to have tons of people who totally disregard whatever she says as, oh, this is hooey and this is crazy and this is mystic and I don't believe any of it. And I also think that it's important when she first starts getting these visions that she misinterprets one that really kind of fucks
three,
things up for how people
trust
her.
As David pointed out in 20 minutes with, she shouldn't misinterpret three of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
These things always happen in threes.
That's right.
I read a scene where she's trying to prove to the Orthodox priests that she's like, you know, a prophetess, and she says, you know, I'm holding out my hands, you can't shoot me, you know, and they shoot her.
Oops.
So there's like this moment where, you know, her like the mantle of her belief completely fails her, you know. So.
Well, and there needs to be enough, just enough credibility so that it requires active disbelief to put it aside, so that the audience is going to, the reader is going to go, wow, yeah, maybe she's got something. Oh, but they're not going to like that. And sure enough, they don't, and they hunt her down, and whatever the drama is that unfolds.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah.
Gentlemen, we're approaching that sort of end time where we need to kind of close things up and start looking at final observations and suggestions and nuances. So, Jason, just real quick, is there anything that you were really hoping we would touch on that we haven't so far?
Well, the one thing about it is the lack of an antagonist. I've always been fascinated with this idea of there being like the antagonist who is utterly indifferent, you know what I mean, to you. And so I completely am sensitive to the idea of when David said there's no antagonist, you know, so that was very helpful. And I didn't know,
And you can have a completely indifferent antagonist. Look at The Old Man and the Sea.
Sure. Oh, Jack London.
I mean, there's your protagonist and antagonist right there in the title. So that can totally work, but I think in genre, people are going to expect the antagonist to be personified, to actually be somebody who cares and who can be defeated in the end. And here's something, you know, take a big step back. Think about what the book is really about, what the series is really about. You're talking about the tension between knowledge and intuition, as it were. And you've got this tension expressed through your two main characters, George and his wife. How else can you have this theme echo? What in the setting can be bifurcated? What in the antagonist can be bifurcated in this same way? Maybe you have subsidiary characters who reinforce the two different sides. And maybe we talked about that there might be factions among the aliens, that there might be the developers and the anthropologists. And maybe the developers and the anthropologists, maybe that's the fundamental conflict that underlies all three books, which doesn't become visible until the end, is the tension between these two factions of the aliens. Yeah. And that tension is something where our main characters wind up having to aid the minority faction against the majority. So this is a way for your little people to play a big part in a struggle that's even bigger than Earth.
Sure. And that could even be mirrored in the society itself. You know, if the larger story, as David describes, is indeed that struggle between the developers, the rapers, the pillagers, the sensualists, and the intellectuals and the explorers and the curious ones, you can have that same event unfolding within the arcology and have that be a layered experience that just continues to grow and unfold like an onion until you're dealing with, you know, planetary scale issues when you get to the aliens.
Oh, it's the basically you have empathy and non-empathy, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Seeing somebody or some species as sentient and conscious and worthy of like intrinsic, you know, has intrinsic value versus something like a Tyson chicken. You know what I mean? Like that you just chop its head off and make a nugget out of it, you know what I mean?
Well, and the
all nuggets.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Well, and the adversary of both knowledge and intuition is ignorance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems to me that these priests and these high architects who are savvy to what's going on, they're probably so rooted in their tradition and in love with their power over humanity, as far as they're aware of it anyway, are going to be a very vocal antagonist, at least for the first book, thwarting George and Asher as they try and save the people. And they're saying, no, the aliens, they wouldn't say that, but gods have always sustained us. Don't break the rhythm that we've established. Our whole livelihood is based and dependent on us doing the same thing over and over again. And that's not true.
Yeah. Right. And they're going to be terrified of Asher if they have knowledge that she suddenly foresees.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Within that whole construct.
In your first book, you know, those guys are definitely, you know, have that thwarting of the goals of the protagonist face on them, which makes them the antagonists. And culture and society can mirror that as well, because that's often a big antagonist to creativity and knowledge.
The first big manifestation of like everything failing is they have a giant idol that's the AI that like speaks in a loud voice, like Wizard of Oz sort of thing, and then like, because of the imbalance, the AI shuts down. Like, but the visions that Asher has, it's of an idol that's exactly shaped like the one in the temple, but it's made of wood. You know what I mean? So it's like, and so she's like, and so basically the steel idol in the middle of the temple is no longer, you know, it's basically like if all of us worship a computer, it'd be if like the computer just shut down, and like, sure, we keep trying to press the power button and it won't turn back on, and we're like, shit. You know what I mean? Like, what are we going to do now? You know?
And you're kind of throwing your hat then in with the more organic, intuitive thing. If technology can fail, then the logical solution is to go with intuition.
Yeah.
Which you may not want to come out as if you're trying to...
It's a hard sell.
It is a hard sell. Yeah. So, but, okay. David, closing thoughts, last suggestions and observations to send Jason off to craft an epic tale.
take a look at similar stories. I was reminded over and over again of Logan's Run. Yep. There's Universe, also known as Nonstop by Robert Heinlein. Silverberg, or was it Brian Aldiss? No, it was Aldiss. I believe it was Aldiss who wrote Nonstop. Silverberg also did a Generation Ship story. I mean, you're reaching way back into science fiction history here, and so there's a lot of prior art that you need to be aware of. You're going to be in dialogue with this stuff whether you plan to or not. So you should make an effort to at least read the cliff notes of these other stories and make sure that you don't just go over already tread path.
Okay.
Good advice.
Sure.
Brian?
Yeah. The only thing that strikes me sort of at the end here is you have a lot of events and a lot of story structure, and I'm sure that you're already looking at this, but I would say make sure that you spend a little time with your characters in terms of how every event and every piece of structure affects them as a character in relation to each other, because I think that's where you're really going to draw in the other half of your readers after mapping out all of the events and all of the exciting things that are fun to write. Is looking in on the characters and how they interact with each other and really digging into the politics and the social aspect of it.
Absolutely.
But I'm excited, and I think it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And for myself, I'll actually defer back to our guest host, David Levine, when he was just talking about how you look at your characters and you figure out what they're striving for. You have them fail, identifying very specifically, Jason, what the stumbling blocks are, what the first effort is going to be, how it will be thwarted, what the second effort will be, how it will be thwarted, the emotional fallout for those as it resonates off the other characters, and focusing on that. You've got a very cool world. You clearly have the details and the cool stuff down. the trick now, I think, is to navigate a story through all of that cool stuff that tells an authentic tale of people in transition transforming from kept pets to reclaim their ultimate birthright as humans to rise above whatever they're in to achieve their higher destiny, whatever that might end up being. And it's not going to be an easy road for them, and it's not going to be an easy road for you, bud. but keeping an eye on that story, don't worry about the details and the nuance, because I can tell you're a world builder just like I am, so I can I can see the symptoms. But be aware of the characters moving through that awesome, cool world, and that I think will sustain you through. So, and concurrence with everything that's been said, this is a very cool framework, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with it, bud. Well done.
Thanks.
All right. Well, gentlemen, nicely done. Jason, you need to be aware that, with the Roundtable Podcast, for anyone who takes this information and either disregards everything we said as complete bullshit, or, you know, strides forward and uses some or all or most or whatever, if you finally step forward, stride boldly, get this thing written down and put up there in some fashion, whether it's on your website or on an ebook or whatever, we will have you back, Jason, and we will knight you as a knight of the Round Table. And we will plaster your picture up around this, the holy order of knights who have taken it to the next level and actually written the story that they had an idea about. So that's the carrot, right, bud.
Yep.
Cool.
All right. Gentlemen, well done. This has been an excellent, excellent study. David, thank you so much, not only for making the time, but also sharing so generously and elevating the conversation to a level that I don't think Brian and I could have done alone. We're very grateful for your participation.
It's been a pleasure.
Excellent.
Yeah, I feel infinitely smarter than I did an hour ago.
Exactly. I feel uplifted.
That's my job.
And you do it well.
I flipped your brain.
Oh, damn. Amazing. You should charge for this. Oh, wait, you do. But not for this. Jason, thank you, sir, very much for stepping up and offering a story. I know that's never easy. And without you, the roundtable doesn't happen. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. I really, really, really appreciated the opportunity. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I hope there was some literary gold here for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. And as long as we're thanking folks, we will thank our listeners who are tuning in out there. Whether you tuned in the moment this thing dropped into the podosphere, or it's 1,000 years from now and you're all living in an arcology and you've found upon a hidden cache of podcasts and you're listening to us now, thank you so much for tuning in. We deeply, deeply appreciate it. If you want to help us out, just spread the word. Let other folks know about the coolness that is the Roundtable, and you will be buying Brian and I both a cup of coffee and a croissant, a chocolate chip croissant with a drizzle of cinnamon sugar syrup on top.
Ooh,
yeah, absolutely.
Dave,
it's that huge.
Very dangerous.
It's huge. It's big. Mm. So, Brian, closing thoughts at all as we wrap this bad boy up?
No, I had a great time on this one. I think, as I do on all of them, but I think you said it, that David Levine really did a great job of, you know, elevating the level of conversation, and I think it's a great story that Jason brought. And so, thanks to both of you. And that's pretty much it. And
I kind of agree. Yeah. I kind of agree.
Thank you very much.
It was awesome.
Yeah, this classic roundtable goodness.
That's right.
And friends, if you think this is where it stops, you're wrong. So very, very wrong. Because in just a couple of days, this whole madness, this mayhem, this frothing delight of creativity, inspiration, and insight, that the engine fires up again with more guest hosts, more brave and brilliant guest writers, more workshopping, more literary gold. So until then, we thank you as always. Brian, any suggestions for pastimes or occurrences that should be unfolding between now and when we meet again?
Yeah, go right.
Yeah, I need to find another way to lead into you on that, because that's
no, it's just, it's funny because the lead in gets longer and longer and longer, and then by the time it gets to me, I'm like,
go right. I got nothing.
No, it's awesome. I dig it. But go right
and do look for awesomeness, because friends, it's been proven time and time again, you find what you're looking for. So look for wow, look for amazing. I swear, I promise you, you will find it. So we will definitely be touching base with you guys in a couple of days. Until then, be cool. We will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you later.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.